Welcome to the HC Insider Podcast, a podcast dedicated to the commodities sector and the people within it. I'm your host, Paul Chapman. Thank you, everyone. Welcome to this HC Insider Podcast live event to discuss the future of Switzerland as a commodities trading hub in a world of energy transition, deglobalization, and digitization. I'd like to thank our sponsors first. Alasso, setting modern standards in derivatives with relevant data and intuitive apps, and Artist Works, a trader and broker workflow ecosystem in the commodities markets. To introduce myself, Paul Chapman, I'm the co-head of HC Group, a search firm in commodities. I'm proud that we've been operating in Switzerland since 2010 and have an office here in Geneva. And also host of the HC Insider podcast as well. Thank you to our panelists, Simon Collins, CEO of Trade Cloud, chairman of HC Group and former global head of metals for Trafigura, Florence Church, who is the secretary general of Swiss Negos, Ivo Sarjanovic, professor at the University of Geneva, former CEO of Alvion and longtime agricultural trader, and Sarah Hunt, partner at HFW and our resident trade and sanctions expert. We'll run for about 45 minutes or 40 minutes or so, and then we'll turn the mics off. This is a recorded podcast, so please do, if you've got your phones, turn them on silent. But we'll run for about 45 minutes, and then we'll turn the mics off and have a Q&A session, which I'm sure will be lively given some of the questions we've been fielding, and then retire for drinks and canapes. So I guess before we talk about the current situation with Switzerland in the world, the wake of Russia's invasion of Ukraine and sanctions, the rise of the Middle East, Abu Dhabi and Dubai as a commodities trading hub, it'd be great to build up a picture of how Switzerland and Geneva in particular became the dominant commodities trading hub in Europe over the last 20 years. Maybe Ivo, you can give us some history on the initial stages of how Switzerland became that hub.
Okay, some of them I knew already, some of them I found getting ready for the panel, so we'll try to combine them. First of all, there were several companies already here before the First World War, like André, for example, that was one of the top agriculture companies, and André was the A of the ABCD before it got replaced by ADM. Then Nestlé, then Volkart, and then after the Second World War is when things start moving. Some US companies, they came here after the war because it was the right place to be during the effort after the Second World War. Cargill, for example, came in 1956. It was the right place to be. It was neutral. It was very international. It looked like the phones work better here than in other places, so that was helpful as well. And during the Cold War, it was also the right place to be to connect the two different blocks. And then in the 70s, when you have the oil crisis, some of the energy companies came to Geneva as well. In the 90s, at the end of the USSR dissolution, Russian companies started coming here. And then the last big wave was related to the last super cycle from 2006 until 2012, when a lot of companies came to Geneva. I think also the banking system, a reliable banking system, the Swiss franc since the 40s was one of the few convertible currencies. The capital account was open, so it was easy to pay and to collect. Insurance companies, surveyor companies. I didn't know, for example, that SGS was in charge of controlling the Marshall Plan after the Second World War, so I found that interesting as well. So I think you built an ecosystem, bits and pieces, with a lot of things that made it very strong, together with the quality of the people, did that it was a good, basically.
Yeah, I guess we're going to unpack that ecosystem of trade finance and people and the critical mass it's created. But I guess, Sarah, can you comment as well, perhaps dig into a bit more recent history? Obviously, the oil trading houses are here, and I see the king of oil right there.
Paul, you've hit the nail on the head. I also did a little bit of prior reading. Hello to all of those friends, students, colleagues, clients. Welcome. So lovely to see you all here today. And some of you will have read this book, which is The Secret Lives of Mark Rich, the King of Oil. the only authorized by Daniel Amann. I think the answer, Paul, to your question as to how it is that Switzerland remains still the focus for so much of the world's trading is in three simple responses. Christian Weyer, doyen of trade finance, the man who at BNP Paribas created a collection of acolytes and built the beginnings of what we take for granted now, which is trade finance. My Dubai clients tell me that if they ask for a letter of credit in Dubai, they won't actually have lines. They have to provide the money. Here in Switzerland, we have an extraordinary network of banks and skills that has, of course, been built up over the centuries. I also took a little look at the history, and it's really impressive how Switzerland has skillfully positioned itself in the market. And at the core of that is, of course, its skill, its neutrality, the fact that it's such a wonderful place for all of us to live, and that what I see as actually its biggest competitor, London, just across the channel here, doesn't quite offer the same extraordinary package. But of course, when you make the comparison that Paul were going to make in the course of this panel between Switzerland and the UAE, you can really see a dramatic skill set. The university degrees that Igor and I teach that Swissnegos has helped set up, that many of us in the room have attended as either lecturers or as students, it's part of the culture of Switzerland, the international trade culture, that I think we can be quite proud of.
Thank you for that. Just before we turn to how government and NGOs and so forth around the system have built that ecosystem and advocated for it, particularly obviously Swissnegos, Simon, just to you, why? I mean, it did take a long time to build up that ecosystem to where it is today, but what was it about Switzerland initially that did attract the likes of Mark Rich and all of the successor companies to that, in your opinion?
Well, I would say it's a place which is very pro-business in general, the trading and that point that you made around neutrality, it's also quite important. One of the things I would say is that, you know, I've managed and run trading businesses over a period of 20 years in Switzerland, and I can't think of a single time where we had a work permit which was denied to us. So, you know, there is a process. You need to go through that, but in the end, the system works. And yes, to a certain extent, the general environment, the security which is here, the administration which works very efficiently, the tax regime and the general stability, I think, are the key elements which will attract any type of business into Switzerland. But, you know, given the, let's say, cost structure, et cetera, I think it's particularly adapted to trading industries.
Mm. And then, Florence, we were talking before we started about somewhat unique the engagement that the trading community has with the authorities and the reciprocity of that compared to what we're going to talk about, what we see in the EU and elsewhere. Mm-hmm. Can you give us some sense of, I guess, that piece of the puzzle and how that helped build Geneva in particular, and again, Switzerland more broadly, to that kind of critical mass of traders?
Thank you, Paul. Just before answering your question, I have just a comment on the three previous speakers about all the advantages that we can have in Switzerland. So you talked about the skilled workforce, about education, about tax, et cetera, et cetera. But there is also something which is we are in the perfect time zone, because from Geneva, from Switzerland, but also from London, you can work in the morning with Asia and in the afternoon with the Americas. So that's very helpful for traders which work for worldwide. Mm. So to come back to the role of basically of the association engaging with the authorities, it's because of our democratic system that we have in Switzerland the politicians, they always consult, the government always consult the associations, political parties, cantons, cities, before drafting a law. It's what we call the consultation phase. It lasts for 3 months, and every association, partners, stakeholders have 3 months to give their position to the government on the future law. And Swiss Negos very often answer to the government, taking position on the different future laws which are going to be drafted. And then with the Swiss democratic system, then the government decided and it goes, the message goes to the parliament. And then you have the lobby phase in parliament. But if you are a very good lobbyist, you do that before the parliamentary phase, because you lobby to the government first and after at parliament if you didn't succeed before. So that's the importance of the association, is really to have all the position of all the trading hubs, you know, the banks active in trade finance, the traders of the different commodities, the insurances, all the stakeholders, and we can bring the voice of the industry to the government.
So a couple of more points I really want to sort of get before we move on to current events, and that is tax and trade finance, right? I mean, there is this perception out there that Switzerland, Geneva, you know, is a much lower tax jurisdiction than the rest of Europe. But, I mean, Ivo, maybe you can comment on this.
At the corporate level is fine, but at an individual level and in some brackets is pretty high. So people believe that we don't pay taxes here, but yeah, we pay taxes and they are pretty high. Mm.
But it is true that there's more, I guess, flexibility would be the word, more ability to negotiate with the cantons when you're moving a business here, right, than perhaps other parts of Europe. The UK, again, which is kind of that, has been historically that rival for commodities. Can you talk to that, or Sarah?
Look, I do think that Switzerland has relatively low taxes compared with certainly some of the higher jurisdictions. If you look at Australia, the UK, especially some of the Scandi states, obviously they are relatively low. They could also be considered quite high when you look at the Middle East and Dubai. My colleagues in Dubai pay no tax. That's for individual tax I'm obviously speaking about. Corporation tax, look, capital gains tax, it's a very helpful feature. I think the individual deals that can be cut in Switzerland are obviously very business friendly. And look, just ask our friends in Zug how they feel about their personal income tax. We have close friends who moved in order to benefit from a lower cantonal tax rate. So I see it as, quite honestly, when you take into account the trifecta of taxes that aren't too bad, the extraordinary advantages you can get through the Swiss system of paying into your second pillar, talk to your accountant about that one, coupled with relatively low interest rates. I do think that it presents a really interesting package to people, including at the lower to middle range of incomes.
Thank you. Simon, you've set up multiple businesses here and moved from the east of the country to Geneva.
It's all about structuring, isn't it? I mean, at the end of the day. And obviously, some structures work very well for certain types of companies. So private employee-owned companies, you point out about the capital gains tax is zero. So that's an advantage if you have a company which is growing quickly and obviously the share price is increasing and you have your share scheme approved by the authorities, which is, again, a relatively straightforward process. So that's obviously significantly advantageous. And I think it's something which encourages people to be entrepreneurial. I mean, there's no business more entrepreneurial than trading, and we can see how the companies are adapting to the new environment, whether that be sanctions, whether that be energy transition. They're moving and they're changing. So it's not a static thing. It's just very, very dynamic. Just as an additional point on taxes, obviously, things like withholding taxes on interest, you know, commodities business is an extremely marginally profitable business. It's a huge volume activity with low margin. But if you have issues, as you may do in other countries where you have withholding tax on interest, then that's a killer. So you need, again, the right legal framework and the right concessions to make the business operate. Mm.
Florence, are you with Swiss Negos? I mean, is this a key part of sort of advising companies or not?
Well, we don't really advise company to come to Geneva or to compare because we are a national association, so we represent our members, whether they are in Zug, in Freiburg, in Zurich, in Vaud, in Geneva. So I cannot make competitions between the canton. I leave it to law firms and audit companies to do these kind of things.
Okay, so the second, that's the tax piece. And well, I guess we'll come on to what potentially global tax means, and obviously that's has more of an impact on the UAE necessarily than here. But the other bit is that trade finance part, which is absolutely the lifeblood of commodities. There really is an ecosystem here, a very powerful trade finance capability. Before we talk about sort of what's not in the UAE, can you give us some sense, Sarah, of what's here and the scale of that and how that unlocks trading?
Sure. Look, I think that Switzerland probably has the best center worldwide for this particular skill of trade finance. And I think of all the many positive aspects of living in the city of Calvin or anywhere in this beautiful country, that has been what has attracted the traders because it's a skill set that's not necessarily replicated in quite the same way. It's a set of factors. I was really interested to read that Christian Veyer, who I referred to earlier, who I actually had the privilege of meeting, funnily enough, in this room a number of years ago, he came up with this idea that rather than insisting on funding of trades being based on the company's P&L, you'd base it all on the value of the goods that were traded. And that wasn't something that was done before he invented it. Mm-hmm. He was a Frenchman that worked for BNP Paribas, and that was why BNP became such, you know, the green dragon, the most extraordinary trade finance bank in the world, I think, in its day. I remember going to those fantastic parties that they used to put on before the big fine from the US was imposed, because it was sort of the French get a little over-enthusiastic. The problem there, incidentally, on the big fine was they didn't pay quite enough attention to their sanctions lawyers, which, of course, is critically important then as it is today. But Christian developed this business. He had a number of young, clever things. He wanted young trade finance bankers who could sort of stand up to the traders. He describes the moment he sat down with Mark Rich to cut the deal, which helped Rich build the business that became Glencore when Rich left Fibro to took five or six traders with him to set up Glencore. And when he was negotiating with Veyer, he said, according to the book, you've got to give me this. And he was effectively bluffing. He said, look, it's not good enough. He made to move, leave the room. You know, it's not good enough. He needed those lines to make his business function. He needed the bank a lot more than they needed him. And Christian was impressed. He said, I like this guy. I'm gonna fund his business. And you know, these early interactions and the I think that very Swiss attention to detail, preparedness to go the extra mile. I mean, you know, it's that which has made Switzerland such a fantastic place in terms of really, you know, moving commodities around the world, which is what we do.
Mm. Big fan, I think. So one final bit, which I guess is close to my heart as with HC Group, is the talent piece. And just, I guess to set the scene a little bit, it was really in the beginning of the last decade, so the early 2010s, when you'd had a lot of incumbents here, particularly in the ags and the metals piece. And most of those metals traders were in Zug, you know, the eastern part of the country. And suddenly we started having a wave of oil trading in particular, energy trading more broadly, come to Geneva again, I think, in particular. And, you know, traders like to be with traders, right? There's a critical mass effect of having those people there. But, in you know, with traders paid the way they are, incentivized the way they are, they're very attracted to be here for a variety of reasons. There was the challenge, certainly initially, about getting the more junior talent to move here, mainly from London, if we think about the dynamics, where, you know, salaries weren't so lucrative and cost of living was higher here, right? And it's taken a bit of time to build up the pool of talent, the critical mass here, so that organizations feel comfortable being here. Ivo, you're obviously a professor at the University of Geneva and a key part of bringing through the new talent. How have you seen that talent dynamic, the landscape change over the last 20 years?
Well, the first initiative was 2006-07, when we were realizing that because of the big inflow of companies coming in that period, there was a problem to develop local talent. And it was expensive to bring people from abroad as well. So at that moment, it was the GTSA, the Geneva Trading and Shipping Association, that sat with the authorities to develop a program. And so the university launched in 2008 the first master in commodities, which is still, this year is the 16th, I think, round. It's a great program, I think. You combine there people working part-time for the companies with Fridays and Saturdays in university. It's a program of 3 semesters and 30 to 35 students every year, which are sponsored by different companies. And in most of the cases, they stay with companies at the end of the process. Then for people who are working in companies and they want to understand a bit more what the companies are doing, but they are not students, only people with 10 to 15 years of experience, there is a diploma that they can get after 1 year. And lately, they develop a certificate that you can do virtually, which is similar to a diploma, but in a bit of a shorter version. And then there are other things also in Switzerland on top of, well, Geneva has also some courses done for professionals by Swiss Negos, that probably you can explain later a bit better. There is the Haute École de Genève, has a bachelor in international management with a minor in commodities. And there are new things also now in Lucerne, in Lugano. And for lawyers, there is a master in commodity trading law in the University of Fribourg. So there are many things that...
Which is relatively unique, right? I mean, there's a couple of programs in the US dedicated to commodities. But in general, you know, the academic community is not necessarily particularly engaged in this sector. And the sector itself, I would argue, doesn't do a great job of advertising itself, you know.
Yeah, there are not many things outside. You have, there is a good program in the Rotterdam University for executive studies. There is something in Colorado. There is something in Singapore. But I don't think you have many other things there. It's a pretty small world for commodities.
And it's interesting that this reflects the fact that what we know is that Switzerland is a commodity trading hub. It was actually Alida Sebeni who approached us, indeed. He first approached my dear partner, Jeremy Davies, who designed that university course, the University of Fribourg. We, HFW, International Trade Shipping Law Firm, still teaches, I think, the lion's share of that program, shipping trading, sanctions, insurance, export controls. And I think we also do trade finance, a couple of other elements. But it's great fun. I mean, the students, you know, I really enjoy this aspect of my job, which is just teaching, like Igor, twice a year. So to be clear, I'm only teaching a total of 4 days a year, mainly just being a paper pusher. But there's a real energy that comes through when a real enthusiasm for this area. And it's funny the way people just fall into international trading. If they're lucky enough to have some contact with this industry, then perhaps it's a little more obvious getting into it. But I think these degrees are helpful. I think as an international commodity trading community, we need to start to maybe look at advertising these courses a little better.
I agree.
Certainly there seems to be, since I've been involved in the teaching over the past 10 years, there seems to be a constant call for expertise in the sector worldwide. and also interest in getting into these diplomas. Very often we have interns in our offices, people who are just so excited to have the opportunity to just hear about, to learn about this, the very latest from a close friend in Sydney whose daughter now wants to do, you know, take this career path. And it would be nice, I think, to maybe share some of this expertise a little more broadly. I know we're very proud of the, you know, the extraordinary knowledge that we've built up here, but there's relatively limited opportunities to study these topics outside of Switzerland.
Yeah,
the combination of academics and professionals, I think that makes a very strong combination really for the students. They have the possibility to learn directly from people who are working in the field. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty unique, I think.
The HC Insider podcast is brought to you by HC Group, a retained search, intelligence and advisory firm focused solely on the global energy and commodity sector. With 6 locations across Asia, Europe and the Americas and over 50 consultants. To find out more, go to our website, hcgroup.global. There, you can also sign up for our HC Insider content for more interviews and white papers on relevant trends and talent impacts in the commodities world.
It's particularly unique because the student, they have to have an internship. And as far as extending the master degree, that would be wonderful, but that means we would need to have more companies hiring interns.
Sponsoring.
Because now we are, for instance, for the master's starting in September, we are in the process of organizing a speed recruiting. So we organized 1,800 meetings in 2 days. It's online for sure. We have about 350 students who have been accepted by the university. So they answer the university requirement to follow the master. And now, with the 350 students, companies can choose which one they want to hire. And all their CV are on a platform. So they can go on the platform and ask Swiss Negos to say, okay, I would like to have the 10 minutes, that's why we call it speed recruiting, 10 minutes interview with this student, with this one, and it lasts for over 2 days. And usually we have about, it's around 25, 30 companies taking students. But last year we had huge success because it was something like 36 students.
Yeah, that's the biggest group.
And that was the biggest class. And for this year we expect more or less same because we already had many companies.
Yeah. Some companies sponsor up to 5-6 students. I saw last year at ING, I think they sponsor 6 students.
Yeah, so we try, some companies, they even want more students, but we try to explain them not more than 5 because then it becomes...
Well, there's
ING commodity master or Cargill commodity master or so. So we try to...
There's definitely, you know, we see it right across the sector. The volatility, the energy transition, lots of organizations, producers, refiners, miners are all trying to build trading capabilities. It's great to hear a crop of young people coming through. Actually, the challenge is that mid-career individuals, where actually, because we had a pretty, you know, challenging 10 years in the last decade, lots of people left the industry, lots of people weren't recruited into it.
I would say that's been a repeating cycle. It happened also in the 90s as well. The margins were very, very low in the business. It was a very tough time. Tech industry was picking up, and people do transition. You know, it's actually funny because Ivo's son and my son, they went to school together, and I just realized that they're also both in the commodities business by chance, right? One in the ags business and one in the oil, which is also another thing. And I know Matteo is speaking 4 languages. My son speaks 4 languages. That's part of what you need as well. I think, yes, the academic side is important, but it's also a job where you learn on the job because it's a very competitive environment, as I explained, and also it's continuously changing that dynamic. You need to be very flexible and adaptable. And I also think, you know, the people that are involved in the industry, they need to be sent out and they need to come back. It's no it cannot be that you just sit in head office and you spend your time there. And certainly at Trafficker, we spend a lot of time repositioning people around the globe. To your point, in terms of experience, we also ran a junior trader program, which was to bring a little bit more mid-tier talent. So there was school leavers, there was grad program, and there was junior trader assessment program as well, which was basic. And then, of course, using companies like Human Capital to recruit core talent, I would say, or very specialized areas, right? You can't put a junior on the Cape trading desk. You need a person who's got 10, 20 years experience, right? So, and the risks are there as well, because the cost of making a mistake is high. So I still, yes, these are very good initiatives, but it's definitely, it's complex, especially in the physical business, and you need to continuously push people through from operations and then into risk management and then onto trading desks. So you need to develop and retain talent along the way.
And also to answer your questions, I think communication is one of the main reasons we have so many students and so many young talent being interested to come into the industry, because with the COVID, with the war in Ukraine, with all the news on the Red Sea issue for shippings and things like that, more and more people nowadays, they realize that what they use during their everyday life doesn't come from the backyard of the house, but comes from far away. And by doing all this communication and talking and explaining, then motivate young people to come to the industry.
Which I think is a peculiarly Swiss thing. You know, being sat in Houston, you know, I would argue that the general sort of zeitgeist is one of, don't go and join an energy company, mm-hmm. you know, go and join Google. Whereas actually, if you want to affect the energy transition, you're better off joining an energy company than you are a company that just consumes a lot of power and materials. But we need to move on. So that's my own hobby horse. But so, okay, so obviously it's been an extraordinary couple of years with COVID, but particularly to this story is Russia's invasion of Ukraine in the context of a broadening deglobalization, decoupling of trade, and the US government in particular using the US dollar as an extension of foreign policy. And in the wake of that, we saw a lot of organizations, particularly oil trading organizations, that had a focus on the east of Suez, Russia in particular, move to Dubai or Abu Dhabi or elsewhere. You know, Sarah, this is your bailiwick. Can you, like, sanctions, they're incredibly complex, it's hard to understand. They're multifaceted in their affecting finance, shipping, ownership. You know, is this going to be is this going to be a long-term drain of organizations from Switzerland to jurisdictions where they are less, they have more protection from, you know, from reach by these sanctions?
Okay, good question. So as of 23-24 Feb, 2 years ago, our firm and my team, together with Dan Martin, who heads up our international sanctions team, were absolutely inundated with queries, which were sort of screamed by emails or on telephones from multiple jurisdictions from our worldwide offices. So we're a big law firm. There are 180 partners worldwide, and I was heading up the basically European and Asia Pacific response. The short answer to the question, Paul, is that that rush has passed as essentially Europe, the States, the UK, along with Australia and Canada, extricated itself over phased months in a series of 12 regulations that came in from the EU from most trade with Russia. In response to that, of course, a number of oil traders and metal traders, product traders evidently, moved from Switzerland to Dubai. On the other hand, it's also true that there are a number of traders that haven't been affected by this really at all in Switzerland because they didn't do business with Russia. And we need to remember that trade is global. And when we speak about sanctions against Russia, we need to remember that most obviously crude oil is still lawfully being lifted from Russia as long as it is below the price cap and not coming into Europe or the States or Australia or Canada and not being lifted directly from an entity which is controlled by a sanctioned, listed person. So what's going to happen in the future? Dubai's booming, there's no question of that. I went to Dubai to do a sanctions seminar actually a few months ago and bumped into a number of friends in the lift in the IDRC. It's a very successful town. What is the level of regulation there? Look, we need to remember, of course, that banks, insurers and reinsurers, most of that is within the G7. It's most insurance, reinsurance is still traded or reinsured out of London. So there is this huge gap in terms of your sophisticated trade, finance and insurance and shipping skills, which is being filled by the dark fleet for trading crude oil in particular over the cap. And of course, you will have seen it has moved, the market has moved up in the past couple of months, and we now have we now see that crude oil is being traded above the cap more than it was. It was sort of easier for it to stay below the cap until that that mark, that 60 US per barrel was surpassed. And look, it's creating tensions. It's creating tensions when Russian traders are looking to hopefully respect, or when any trader is looking to respect the cap when purchasing from Russia. How is Dubai going to go into the future? Look, I hope that it's going to increase the extent to which it implements regulations that reflect the current, shall we say, Western level of regulation. Until that happens, it's a little bit of the Wild West out there. We've got, you know, traders that are trading product using their own funds. You've got a much less regulated environment. I think one of the concerns I have, whilst this position persists, is what might happen if there were a serious international oil spill with somehow insurance not coming into play. And that's, of course, a concern that's been reflected by Financial Times and lead journalists who are considering these issues.
This is 10% of the fleet is the dark fleet and not necessarily the best maintained or with the long-serving captains and so forth. I don't know if any of you have comments on that.
I think there's an interesting navigation here because we've got the cargo, the price of the cargo, the ship, the insurance, and the individual who's actually trading that cargo or even booking the ship. So it's become like a matrix of different things that you need to follow in order to determine, can I do this or can't I do this? So we heard at the FT conference last week, every trading company is enormously increasing their compliance department. And if they've got any sense, they'll also be increasing their AI, their digital tools, specifically AI, to monitor the activity of what's going on across the trading floor because everything is being communicated across chat and email, et cetera, right? So it's a big challenge, but big challenge becomes a big opportunity, and we can see that the what has resulted is extraordinary profits of trading companies, particularly in the oil and gas industry over the last 3 years. So it's been, and I think that's the thing with trading companies is that they are really quick to adapt. They see a situation, they deal with it, and corporates, of course, are much slower, much more difficult to make decisions in a timely manner. I think it's been the trading industry, whilst it's come under a lot of criticism for trading oil with Russia and this type of thing, generally speaking, I think it's enormously assisted in creating liquidity in the market and providing product to essentially where it's needed, which has been particularly sensitive in Europe.
Yeah, and I don't think it's been lauded enough for solving the energy crisis. Right, and we see that, I think, in a lot of the current EU regulation that's not necessarily engaging traders. Just in the time left, as we look towards the future, yes, we've got a deglobalizing world and you know, and organizations are going to have to make their choices about where and when they want to operate and what that means from locations. And I think your point, Sarah, is perhaps the rush is over, you know, and there's relatively strong reasons that we've discussed for why Switzerland will continue. The two other big trends that at least we see in the commodities world is one is digitization and the other is obviously the energy transition. So I guess staying with you, Simon, and perhaps Florence, you can comment on this. A huge part of commodity trading going forwards is it doesn't necessarily need to be AI. It probably gets branded AI because that's, you know, gets you the better multiple. But using technology to lower costs and make faster trading decisions. And it seems to me that there's quite an ecosystem that's been built here, not legislatively around, you know, cryptocurrencies and blockchain technology, but, you know, also just the lots of platforms seem to have started up in Switzerland compared to what I would have argued would have been historically a London capability. Maybe Simon, you're at the forefront of this. Can you?
A lot of also have been started up in London as well, but they are represented in Geneva as well, because mm-hmm. obviously customers are here. So I think it's iterative and it's progressive. And yes, you're right. There's a lot of talk about AI, and we could talk about, you know, learning algorithms and you know, whatever, and blockchain, etc. But at the end of the day, if tools work, if they make a trader's job easier, then if it can provide them with more information, then that trader is going to adopt that tool, right? So that's, I think, the most important thing. And cloud technology is really the base layer, which has made everything possible. In terms of energy transition, I think we heard some quite almost shocking statistics around the amount of energy that generative AI could potentially use over the next 5 to 10 years. Richard Holman of Trafigura mentioned something like 80% of the increase in energy, electricity consumption, I think, to 2030 in the US alone, which is just, it's just extraordinary. Mm. Of course, what do we need for that? We need metals, right? So we need copper, and we need aluminium, and we need tin, and all the things which go with that. So also interesting to see. There's a little bit of swings and roundabouts with the trading companies, but Vitol seems to be making a move back into metals after a 25-year pause. We hear Mercura is hiring some bigger hitters for their metals department. IXM is here now, which is, I think, quite a significant move rather than being somewhere else in the world. And they're front and center with the energy transition, cobalt, copper, nickel. So it's good to see. And then there's, okay, we have a lot of traditional trading companies that were born from companies like Mark Rich / Glencore and Trafigura, et cetera, which have been in the ores and concentrates business for some time. So there's actually, I think, more going on. Energy is stealing the headlines most of the time and seem to be the ones in the most amount of trouble. But metals business is actually going strong in Switzerland as well. Mm.
Florence, any comment on, so I guess...
Yes, I just wanted to comment on what you said, because we always write a magazine every year, and we have an article. It just came up at the FT conference. We published it at the occasion of the FT. And actually, Claire, she has some magazine in case you want some. And there is the article of Risha Altom from Trafigura explaining the price of AI. In terms of energy consumption, et cetera, et cetera. So please feel free to read the magazine.
I'll put links in the show notes.
I'll just add a little comment there. I'm sure we'll all be very relieved to hear that the EU worked late on the 8th of December to pass the AI EU Artificial Intelligence Act.
There we go. So the energy transition, and Ivo, you and I had a chat before with this one of your former colleagues at Cargill. What it is doing is sort of colliding and bringing together all of the historically quite siloed strands of the commodities world. If you were an ags trader, you didn't really need to care about what was going on in metals or oil, you know, and now you do with the advent of biofuels. If you're an energy trader, you now absolutely need to have a lens on power, which then causes a need for the lens on metals. Switzerland has historically been strong in ags, strong in metals, and strong in oil more latterly. You know, are we seeing the energy transition, like in your, the students you have, you know, are we seeing a new critical mass start to form in gas and power, and, you know, and that desire to be, have a more of a cross-commodity lens?
I don't know much about gas and power. The only thing I can say is, in terms of the agris, you were speaking about the integration of energy companies and metals, and I think there is a threat for the agri companies that if eventually the energy companies decide to go into the agri space, I think that could become really interesting. They were very profitable in the last years, and I'm pretty sure they're sitting in a lot of equity, and that could be an alternative that probably can change a bit the landscape if any of them they decide to go into the agriculture sector.
Yeah. I mean, moderator turned panelist, I would suggest that the, you know, the weight of gas and power trading historically was in the UK, and we certainly see that changing. And it has, you know, changed over the last decade as those oil trading houses in particular have been building LNG desks and power desks, and Europe being very much sort of the centre of an opportunity in power trading. So I think that's probably a critical mass that we'll see. And Simon, if you have any comments on that?
Well, yeah, the next one will be carbon as well, right? So it was interesting to see, again, some of the contradictions. Some traders are saying, well, we're entering this market because it's profitable. Some people say because it's a junk to our other businesses. At the end of the day, it amounts to the same thing. But there are clearly very, very large opportunities which are emerging in power and gas, as we can see, and the carbon market is definitely going to expand. It needs regulation. It needs standardization. But it could be the next big shiny thing, I think. I think the other interesting areas will be the other aspects around ESG. So particularly water, which is something which is close to me with a company that I'm working with in Berlin called Watergenics, specifically work on water quality, because all the industries that we talk about here is agriculture, massive consumer of water, power industry, huge consumer of water. And the mining industry has significant water problems as well, both in mining and in processing. So I think that could also be something that we can see in the future as people start to get more interested in the water industry, how to deal with it, and also the perspective for blue bonds going forwards, which could be on comparative to the carbon market.
Mm. Thank you very much, everyone. We'll retire for drinks.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and want to support the show, please give us a positive review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify.
To find out more about HC Insider and HC Group, a search and advisory firm dedicated to the commodity markets, visit our website at www.hcgroup.global. There you can find out more about our services and our offices around the world. There you can also find more content, from interviews to insight pieces to more podcasts focused on the commodity value chains. Thanks again for listening.